There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns.
And thank you every week to Uncle Donald for reminding us there are known unknowns. And this is the time of the week when we get people in who are really, really clever and who know stuff. And you get a chance to ask them about stuff, known unknowns. And today we're looking at sleep. Professor Sean Drummond is president of the Sleep Research Society. He's a professor of clinical neuroscience at the Monash University Institute of Cognitive and Clinical Neurosciences and their sleep program. Oh, that's a mouthful. He's an expert on sleep. He's here to answer your questions. Sean, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Generally, we don't get enough of it, do we?
Many people do not. Yeah, the average adult gets around 7 hours of sleep, which is right at the bottom of the recommended amount for adults.
How much is too much?
That's actually a bit of a controversial question. There are data to suggest that getting, say, over nine and a half hours of sleep is associated with poor long-term health, poor outcomes long-term. But it's a little unclear whether that's the sleep that's creating the poor outcomes or there's other health issues that are both related to the long sleep and the poor outcomes. So it's a little bit less clear that, long sleep is bad for you. It's very clear that, not getting enough sleep is bad for you.
Over a long period of time, you build up a sleep deficit. I think that's well understood. But we always talk about quantity. Shouldn't we also talk about quality?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The quality of sleep is very important. So we know, for example, that, say, 5-6 hours of really good quality sleep is probably better for you, certainly makes you feel better than, say, 8 hours of very broken, fragmented, up and down sort of sleep.
Do we make some fundamental mistakes in our lives? Well, let's not talk about exercise. Let's not talk about diet. Let's talk about screens, for instance. It is very common now for people either to be watching TV or surfing the internet or checking messages or social media immediately before trying to go to sleep. How bad a combination of those things?
So there's two things that make that very bad. Most of our electronics, our personal electronics these days, emit a light that's heavy in the blue frequency, and that is the part of the light that's most active in our brain, telling us that it's a time to be awake. So if we have our tablets and our phones very close to our face receiving all of that blue light right before bedtime, we're actually sending signals to our brain that you should be awake, not be asleep. And that obviously then makes it harder to fall asleep. It can actually even shift your rhythms almost like you're traveling across time zones if you do it frequently enough.
Like jet lag at home.
It can be like jet lag at home, absolutely. And the second thing that makes screens bad is when we play with them in bed, because there we're training our brain that the bed is a place to be awake, not the place to be asleep.
And I mean, it's stimulation. Is it a different type of stimulation, though, to reading a book or a magazine before trying to fall asleep?
It can be. It depends on how engaged you are in whatever you're looking at and whether what you're looking at online is relaxing or whether what you're looking at is engaging. Same with a book, for example, right? I'm reading the Game of Thrones books right now, and my I read them before bedtime, I get pretty engaged and my brain gets rolling and it's hard to go to sleep. So there's a lot of individual variability in what it is that alerts you versus relaxes you.
Okay. So are there some true, tried and tested methods, guarantees that can improve people's capacity to get to sleep, to stay asleep and to wake up refreshed? Are there any guarantees?
That all depends on what's creating the problems in the first place, sadly. So there's no simple, easy answer. If you have insomnia, it's one set of strategies.
If it wasn't an easy answer, you wouldn't have a job, would you?
Yeah, that's right. It wouldn't be a very interesting life.
So there are strategies.
There are strategies. And so there's one set of strategies if you have insomnia. There's a different set of strategies if you have sleep apnea.
Which is the extreme snoring thing.
It's when you stop breathing at night. It's related to snoring. Yep. You know, there's different strategies. If you're just an occasional problem and say you have problems sleeping only when you're really stressed out. So, you know, maybe some of our callers will have specific questions about what's going on in their lives, but it's the one simple mantra that I can give people is do nothing in bed but sleep and sleep nowhere but the bed. And what we're trying to do there
– do nothing in bed except sleep.
Correct.
And only sleep in bed. So don't
– sleep nowhere but the bed.
So don't nap on the couch.
That's right.
And also don't, for instance, snack in bed. Or watch TV from bed.
That's correct.
What about sex?
So sex is the exception.
That's good. I just thought we'd check.
Yeah, yeah. People sometimes are funny about moving the location for sex, and so we make an exception for that.
That's good. Okay, but don't snack in bed. Don't have breakfast in bed. Don't watch TV for hours and hours lying in bed is what you're saying.
That's right, and don't even argue with your partner in bed or play with the dog in bed and those sorts of things, because all of those things train the brain that the bed's a place to be awake and alert and thinking and not a place to be asleep.
Letting the kids come in and cuddle in on a Sunday morning, or helping the kids get to sleep by settling down with them? Very common, but
it is very common. It can be a problem, but many times it's not. So, I mean, one of the things we'll probably talk a lot about today are different strategies for getting better sleep. And one of the things I think listeners need to be aware of is that if you are generally a good, healthy sleeper, you don't have sleep complaints, you can break a lot of the rules that I'm talking about and get away with it. It's really when your sleep starts to go bad that you need to tighten down and follow the rules pretty strictly in order to get back on track.
Okay, we've got to go there. Snoring. How big an issue is snoring, and what's the best way? Other than weight loss, which I think goes without saying, other than weight loss, how else can you deal with it?
Well, so lots of people snore. Not everybody snoring is not a problem for everybody. It can be more of a problem for your bed partner, for example, than it can for the person who's actually doing the snoring.
And in some extreme cases, for neighbors.
And if it's a problem for the neighbors, it's probably a problem for the snorer, because they probably have that disorder sleep apnea we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, where the whole house shakes, yes. So other than weight loss, what else can you do about snoring?
So one thing you can do is slightly elevate your head. So essentially snoring occurs because the airway in your throat starts to close when you're sleeping and when you're breathing, and the snoring is essentially the whistling that happens as the air tries to get through the airway. And if you're lying very flat on your back, then you're most prone to having your airway closed, because your tongue and your soft palate and all that stuff, gravity pulls it back into the airway.
As you relax, yeah.
And all the muscles in your neck relax. So one thing you can do is slightly elevate your head, maybe sleep on two pillows.
Sleep on your side?
You can sleep on your side or sleep on your stomach even. So those positional things can really help for someone who snores, but it hasn't reached the point of being a disorder.
And then there's the machinery, which has become very popular.
Yes. Yeah, so if you snore to the extent that you have obstructive sleep apnea, which again is where you frankly stop breathing at night.
Stop, start.
Exactly. Yep. And that you have these really loud snores with these long pauses, and then you wake up with a snort and a gasp. So that's sleep apnea. And there, the gold standard treatment is something called positive airway pressure, which is a little mask that you wear. There's lots of different kinds of masks, and so you can find one that's comfortable for you. And it blows air down your airway to essentially splint it open so it does not close, hence you don't snore, and hence you don't stop breathing.
So you have a little pump by the bed and a flexible hose connected to a mask, a little mask.
That's right. And the mask can either just go over your nose, or it can go over your nose and mouth. Mm-hmm. Some of them just sit right underneath your nostrils. And it's they're very good these days. It's a very quiet pump. It generally does not disturb the sleeper or the bed partners. And it just kind of hums like a quiet fan. It blows air down the airway all night long, and people will get the best sleep of their lives.
I have a mate who says it's changed his life.
Absolutely.
And says it's completely reinvigorated his middle-aged life to a point where he was beginning to despair, and it's just lifted every bit of fog out of his life. So I've never done it myself. Then there are mouth guard devices that the dentists now often sell.
That's right. And
which
they
are
sort
very
of,
popular too.
Yep. So they're kind of a – they are another popular option. They advance the jaw and the mouth a little bit forward so that it does – again, gravity doesn't pull it backwards and collapse into your throat. So that's another one. That generally works with mild to moderate but not severe sleep apnea.
And the advice I got was – and I think this – my personal experience brings this out. Alcohol creates snoring for a lot of people. If I have a drink, if I drink alcohol, I'll snore.
Yep.
If I don't drink, I don't snore.
That's right. And alcohol actually does even more than that to disturb your sleep. So with respect to the snoring, the reason it increases snoring, of course, is it is a relaxant. So it relaxes your muscles more. Your throat's more likely to close. The other thing that alcohol does – so alcohol is actually probably the most common sleep aid that people use And it is probably the worst thing you could possibly do for your sleep. And the reason is if you drink a little bit of alcohol and not so much you pass out, but enough that, you know, you have a little buzz going, you really will fall asleep faster and you get a little bit extra deep sleep at the beginning of the night. So it seems like it's a really good idea. But in fact, what happens is when you metabolize all of that alcohol, which for most people is the middle of the night sometime, right? It's about one drink per hour. Two things happen at that point. One, your body temperature goes up, and it's much harder to sleep when you have a high body temperature because that's what's supposed to happen during the day. The second thing that happens is your brain releases neurotransmitters, these chemical messengers that are much more common during the day than they are at night. So your brain and your body gets all of these signals that it's supposed to actually be awake even though it's the middle of the night. So the result is you often will wake up. Sometimes you'll wake up very hot. You won't be able to fall back asleep. But even if you do fall back asleep in the middle of the night, you'll go in and out of sleep. You'll have very light sleep, and that sleep really won't do you much good.
Let's get to callers. Professor Sean Drummond from Monash University, sleep researcher and expert, is here. Yvonne in Croydon is first up. Hello, Yvonne.
Yes, hello. Hello.
Yes, you're on air now, Yvonne.
I'm wondering how to become a more deep sleeper. I'm a very light sleeper, and the slightest little noises wake me up through the night.
Okay. Ever thought of popping cotton wool in your ears?
Well, I figured that will just make me more of a light sleeper, won't it?
I don't know. Let's ask Sean. What do you reckon, Sean? How do you make Yvonne a heavier sleeper?
Well, certainly one of the recommendation you just made is a very good one in terms of if it's noise that's waking you up or it's light that's waking you up, then earplugs to help reduce the noise or a fan or some other white noise sorts of thing can do it, as well as, if it's light, then wearing an eye mask can certainly help. And then there's some other steps. If those things don't work, there's some other steps you can take.
So that's not going to teach me to be a deeper sleeper. That's just going to stop the cues that cause me to wake up.
Yep. So that's a very good point. So one of the things that helps determine whether we're light or deep sleepers is something called sleep debt. So sleep debt essentially is this process that builds across the course of the day. The longer that we're awake, the more our brain needs sleep. So it's just like hunger, right? The longer we go without eating, the more hungry we get. When we eat, it satiates our hunger, and then it starts to build again until we're so hungry we need to eat another meal. Sleep is the exact same way. The longer we're awake, the more our brain needs to sleep. And we slowly build this sleep debt up. And the more sleep debt we have when we try to go to sleep, the deeper our sleep is. So often what we see, for example, in the clinic when I work with people with insomnia, often what we see is that they haven't given themselves enough opportunity to build a sleep debt in order to get good deep sleep, because they do things like either go to bed early or they sleep in late in the morning, or they take naps during the day. And those things all reduce the ability to build the sleep debt and get good deep sleep.
All right, Yvonne, does that help you?
I need to get tired. That's good. I like it. Yep.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good on you. Jennifer in Sunbury. Morning to you, Jennifer.
Oh, good morning. Look, thank you for taking my call. Look, essentially, I'm a PCA during the day. I work 7.5 hours of incredibly intense physical
PCA, personal
work.
Care attendant.
Care assistant, sorry.
Yes, I got there in the end, Jennifer, yes.
Oh, apologies. And it's also, there's a high degree of stress. So I have a physically intensive day. I'm exhausted by the afternoon, but I do not nap. I'm also an artist, and my primary studio time, it's just the way I work. I work at night. So I'll go to bed at 12, and then I listen to my partner snore off to sleep, and I kind of wake up a little after 4, and waiting for the alarm at 5 o'clock. Obviously, I'm not getting enough sleep because I'm so fatigued in the afternoon. And I'm wondering what I can do to try and get some good, solid, quality sleep in those minimal hours that I do.
Okay,
I am trying. I'm a vegetarian. I'm eating healthier, organic foods.
Everything's working except the sleep side, by the sound of it then, Jennifer.
Well, yeah.
Okay, let's see what Sean says.
Yeah, so there's a couple different things going on there. I think one is clearly, and you're obviously aware of this, is you're not giving yourself enough opportunity to sleep, right? So the latest recommendations are that adults need about 7 hours of sleep for optimal function during the day, optimal health outcomes, and your life is arranged such that you do not get that right now. So certainly one of the things that I would recommend is that you think about how to rearrange responsibilities to give yourself more opportunity to sleep. granted, that's far easier said than done. The other thing you said, actually, which I guess is more on the positive side, is that you seem to wake up at a very consistent time every morning. And that's, believe it or not, actually a very good sign. That probably means that your circadian rhythms, which is the biological process that determines when we're sleepy and when we're alert and when we're awake, right, your circadian rhythms are probably actually very strong because they are waking you up at the same time every day. And that's actually a good thing. That suggests that sleep should be fairly healthy over the long term for somebody like you.
Good luck with that, Jennifer. Sally in Anglesey, good morning. You're through to Sean.
Thank you, John. I think I have a similar thing to Jennifer. A lot of my friends who are female in their 50s seem to be waking around that 4 o'clock time and not being able to get back to sleep and just being exhausted all day. And I'm wondering if there is something known about menopause which causes people to wake up and not be able to get back to sleep again. Is there some sort of chemical imbalance going on?
Well, certainly menopause is known to affect sleep. And there's two things going on. One is that as we age, both men and women lose some of that really deep restorative, what's called slow wave sleep. And for men, we start losing slow wave sleep sometime in our 30s. And so the amount of deep sleep we get kind of slowly dribbles away. Mm-hmm. For women maintain this deep slow wave sleep, that's a very restorative stage of sleep, for most of their sort of adult life through middle age, and then it kind of falls off the cliff right around menopause. This deep sleep when we get lots of deep sleep, we wake up in the morning and think, oh, my sleep did me some real good last night. And so when you lose it all very quickly, you have this subjective sense that your sleep isn't doing you as much good as it used to, and to some extent, it's not. The other issue, of course, is some of the hormonal changes and hot flashes and things like that that you get in menopause, which are real impediments to helping you sleep. And to the extent that hormone replacement therapy and that sort of stuff treats the hot flashes, it can help your sleep.
Mm-hmm. But the deep sleep is the only way to make it better. Is it just something that happens to all women around menopause, their deep sleep reduces?
So it does happen to most men and women, but certainly women around menopause start to lose some of that deep sleep. It doesn't mean that you're destined to never have good restorative sleep for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. While deep sleep is most associated with being rested and refreshed, it's not the only part of sleep that is. And if you get a sufficient quantity of sleep, you'll still wake up feeling fairly good. But the menopause period is a bit of a rough period where there's still active research trying to figure out how do we help women sleep better through this period.
Sally, okay, you are not alone. I've got about 20 text messages from people asking the same question as you.
A lot of people are very distressed about it. Thank you.
Well, okay. It would be very distressing. I completely understand.
Thank you. Bye.
Mark in Ballarat. Morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Sean. I have two particular sleeping issues which no one seems to be able to solve. One is being quite hot in bed and sort of fidgety as well. And the other is going to the toilet a couple of times during the night, just waking up every 3 to 4 hours and needing to go to the toilet and not being able to go back to sleep until I do.
Yeah, so let me take those in reverse order. So the having to pee in the middle of the night is not an uncommon thing. And again, as a theme from this morning, it gets worse as we age. And clinically, what we do when I have folks in our insomnia clinic is we cut back earlier and earlier in the evening when people stop drinking liquids. It's really kind of the only way.
Don't you end up dehydrated then?
Well, if you cut liquids out altogether, you would end up dehydrated. But if you stop a few hours before bedtime, for example, that isn't really a health risk, as long as you're getting plenty of fluids the rest of the day.
Well, that's fair enough, because I was recently just told I needed to up my water intake. So yeah. That still stands, but just make sure that I do it during the day instead of in the evening.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, of course, there's medical issues if you have a urinary tract infection and that kind of stuff. But I'm sort of assuming that's not the issue at the moment. And the other thing you talked about was being very hot at night and being a little fidgety and restless. And those might actually be two separate things. The heat, of course, it is hard to sleep when you're very hot or very cold. And controlling the environment is really the best way to do that. There's not a lot we can do to control our own body temperature. And then the fidgetiness, you know, could be just a sign of restless sleep, or it could actually be a sleep disorder. If that fidgetiness is such that, for example, in your legs, you get these what some people would describe as creepy crawly feelings and these sort of intense feelings that don't go away unless you move your legs. That's something called restless leg syndrome or periodic limb movements when it happens at night. And that is a treatable disorder that if you went to a sleep disorder center, they would be able to evaluate and treat that.
All right. I hope that helped you, Mark. I've got quite literally, there's hundreds of texts. Does dry air make snoring worse? Do humidifiers actually help?
Yes and yes.
So dry air does make snoring worse and humidifiers can help.
Correct.
Okay. In my 50s, been vegan for 40 years. Menopausal, have no problems getting good solid sleep. Can nap easily if needed. It's about routine. So when you say only sleep in bed, people saying, well, that's not what works for me. So I guess everyone has to find what they're comfortable with, do they not?
Yeah, again, and you know, I think the caveat that I gave earlier, which is if somebody is a good, healthy sleeper, there's lots of different ways to get to be a good, healthy sleeper and lots of different patterns that are going to work for particular people. And if it's working and you don't have sleep complaints, more power to you. Keep doing it.
Meditation helps me. Someone else says going for a walk after dinner avoids some of the unpleasantness of trying to sleep with a full stomach. Someone else says, can you help me stop the possums running across the roof? That's what stops me sleeping. Question from Peter in Brighton, amongst many, melatonin, yes or no?
So that first series of things, walking, meditation, that sort of stuff, anything that helps you relax and unwind at night is going to help you sleep better. So all of those are great things. Melatonin, melatonin is really meant to shift the time that we sleep rather than help us sleep. If you take a really big dose, it's going to make you sleepy. But really what melatonins do is to help with, say, shift work or jet lag or delayed sleep phase or something like that.
Someone saying check your thyroid levels. Someone else says men should check their testosterone levels, which has got a lot to do with sleep. Is that true or not?
The relationship between testosterone and sleep is sort of an emerging one, and I think the jury's still a little bit out. The thyroid, yes, if you have a hyperthyroidism, it's going to be harder to sleep. Hypothyroidism, you're going to be more sleepy during the day.
All right, and several people saying best thing I ever did was stop sleeping in the same bed as my partner. Sleeping in separate rooms restores sleep without machines or medication.
For the person who moves rooms, perhaps, yes. It's interesting. We're actually doing some research at Monash right now on sleep in the context of couples and partners and trying to look at those sorts of issues. But if you have someone who snores loud, certainly the other person moving might help that other person get better sleep.
Oh, both, in fact. Joan in Beaumaris, morning to you, Joan.
Good morning. I can get to sleep quite well, but I just can't wake up. I never, ever feel refreshed in the morning. It's like jet lag.
So how long does it take you to get going in the morning, Joan?
Well, look, the alarm goes, I get up, I have a shower, I go to work, and I get up at 6:30. And then perhaps by 10 o'clock, I feel like I'm awake.
Wow, it takes that long. What happens on weekends when you don't have to get up to go to work?
I much prefer, in fact, what's the time now? I'd prefer to be in bed now. I want to stay in bed. That's where I want to be. I wake up and then I think, oh no, this is nice, I'm going to go back to sleep.
And you do?
And I do.
For how long? Well, so on a weekend, what time do you get up?
Well, I often get, on holidays, I'll get up because I feel guilty at 9:30, but I'd prefer to stay, I could stay in bed I stayed in bed till 11. I'd been in bed the night before at 10:30, so I just don't wake up. And sometimes if I'm on a girl's weekend or something, all the others will be up having a chat and a cup of tea, and all I want to do is stay in bed and sleep.
Okay, Sean, what about Joan's situation?
So, Joan, let me ask about the other side of the night. What time are you trying to go to sleep at night?
I usually go to bed at 10:30, and I can go to sleep quite readily.
Okay, so you have lots of sleep opportunity, and it sounds like you're getting lots of sleep. You just feel unrefreshed when you wake up in the morning and would sort of prefer to stay asleep. And so, you know, without knowing a lot more details, obviously it's hard to know exactly what's going on. A couple of things. Certainly you could have a sleep disorder. With many sleep disorders, for example, sleep apnea, periodic limb movements we talked about earlier, you could seem to be getting plenty quantity of sleep, but not enough quality sleep, and therefore you do still feel very sleepy during the day. We also know, for example, things like depression are associated with a high desire to sleep, and sometimes avoidance behaviors that lead you to sleep more during the day.
I actually don't sleep in the day once I'm up. I never do, because if I ever try to, I feel worse after. A half an hour nap is shocking for me, but I never feel the desire to lie down during the day. I'm fine, even at night. I'm happy to stay awake until about 10:30. But it's just the waking up in the morning. Yeah. I just can't do it.
Oh, look, there are many people listening who are jealous, Joan, saying, oh, I wish that could be me.
Look, I think I must have been a sloth in an earlier age.
Well, maybe you're going to be in the next life, Joan. Either way, thank you. Quick text. I'm just like Joan, says Anne. I never feel refreshed when I wake up. So there you go. People saying yoga is good, and I could, Sean, read out text messages between now and Christmas pretty much. Exercise before bed, good or bad, says Dave.
Exercise before bed is good as long as you don't do it right before bed so that you're trying to fall asleep while your heart rate is still high.
People asking questions about shift work, both permanent shift work and other people with shifting shift work or varying shift work, saying, well, how do you ever adjust your sleep patterns?
Yeah, shift work is a tough one because it does throw your sleep schedule all over the place. There's a lot of active research on how to help people get better sleep. And in fact, at Monash University, we're the home for something called the Alertness Cooperative Research Center. We have just opened a new website called workalert.org.au, and that is a treasure trove of resources for shift workers. And so I would encourage folks to take a look at that.
Okay. And it should be illegal to get up before 11 o'clock on the weekend to get out of bed. I love to stay in bed and struggle to, like Joan, to get up in the morning. I quite like that. It should be illegal. Vincent in Melbourne, good morning to you, Vincent.
Just want to know, sex before bed, I find it helps a little bit for sleeping. Is that something that could really work or not?
Well, I think if it's something that works for you, I would encourage you to do it. That's one of those things that often comes up in these sorts of conversations, and we just don't have real good data to say biologically why should sex help you sleep, but certainly there's a lot of people who says it does.
Okay, cool.
Chris in Bendigo, good morning to you, Chris.
Hello, John and Sean. I've got a question. I'd like to know the role the adrenal glands play in sleep.
The adrenal glands?
Yeah.
Adrenaline?
Well, adrenal glands, the glands that sit above the kidneys.
Okay. Sure.
I've heard that they can cause a lot of sleeplessness.
Okay. Sean?
Well, I think that a disorder in, you know, so sleep is one of these things that affects every system in the body, every organ in the body, and lots of the systems and organs in the body can positively or negatively impact sleep. And so I think that, you know, if there is a disorder or a disease in the adrenal glands, that obviously can impact sleep pretty strongly.
Good. Okay.
All right. Thank you. People suggesting vitamin therapy and treatment. Someone else saying valerian. There's all sorts of herbal and other things that people are recommending. Fresh air equals good sleep, says Jim in Glen Waverley. And there's a great text here. To those who wish to be able to sleep like Joan, be careful what you wish for. I have idiopathic hypersomnia. What's that, Sean?
That is a disorder where you are excessively sleepy all day long and truly struggle to stay awake all day long despite getting adequate sleep at night. Okay. It's a very vexing disorder. It's relatively rare, but for those who have it, it is pretty tough.
And it's debilitating, according to this texter. And then Sue in Rye says she's downloaded a sleep app to her smartphone. It records when there's a sound. It shows you how much you talk in your sleep or snore or how disturbed your sleep actually is, so you can review it the next morning. Do you recommend that?
Not necessarily. The problem is with all of the sleep apps that are out there is that there are no independent validation studies, meaning we don't know that what they're telling us is actually the truth. And there's a fair amount of work going on. Our group, for example, is working to validate some of the consumer wearable devices that you wear on your wrist to see how good they are. But the reality is most of these don't have any independent validation done at all. So user beware.
James and Clorinda, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning, Sean and John. I'm a shift worker, and I've got a question in regard to the sleep. I get to sleep very well any time that I go to bed, but I find if I get 7 or 8 hours sleep and wake up at 3:30 in the morning, I'll be a lot more tired than if I get to bed and have 7 or 8 hours sleep and wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning. Is that unusual?
No, not at all. Actually, it makes perfect sense to me because of something called circadian rhythms. So I think I mentioned this earlier. Circadian rhythms, this is a biological process that determines when we should be alert and awake and when we should be sleepy and asleep. And in humans, the biological rhythm is pushing us to be awake during the day and pushing us to be asleep at night. So if you wake up at 3 a.m., you're waking up when your body is pushing you to be asleep. So it makes perfect sense to me that you would not feel as refreshed and alert at that point in time.
Are you a permanent shift worker, James?
My shift work varies. So I'll do 1 week in the morning and then 1 week I'll be doing afternoon and night shifts.
And that switching back and forth is really hard on the body and on the brain, and because sometimes you're sleeping when you're supposed to and sometimes you're sleeping when you're not, and it leads to a lot of sort of internal biological confusion. I would repeat the website I mentioned earlier, and I would encourage you to go to workalert.org.au. There's a lot of good information there, including some sort of self-help tips and things that you can do to try to guard against some of the problems of shift work.
All righty, good on you. Thank you. Andrea says, there are some people I need to avoid during the day if I want a good night's sleep, rather than replaying unsettling conversations from the day over and over. Joe in Ringwood, morning to you, Joe.
Yes, good morning. I'm just trying to find out. I was having trouble with sleep for a little while, and I switched to a compound called P5P, which is a vitamin B compound. And I find I get a much better sleep at night. Any studies being done on that?
Not that I know of. Generally speaking, a lot of that over-the-counter herbal sorts of stuff, when there are studies that have been done, they basically show that they're placebos. They don't really work. At best, they help you kind of relax, and of course, if you relax, you get better sleep, but there's very little data on those things.
So when you say a placebo doesn't really work, in fact, a placebo does work. That's why it's a placebo. But it's the trick the mind is playing on Joe. Joe could swallow a pill of any kind that was harmless, and it may have the same effect as what you're saying the science tells us.
Correct. And the placebo effect is actually very strong in sleep. So it's very easy to take something and believe it's going to help you, and then it does.
And therefore it is working.
And arguably, therefore, it is working.
It's not working because of what's in it. It's working because of what it is.
It's working because of the psychology of it, absolutely.
Yes. How does that affect you, Joe?
Yeah, I've given it a try, and I've found that I only take one of them at night when I do feel I need the sleep, but I do find whether it's placebo or not, it does give me a good night's sleep.
Absolutely. I would keep doing it then.
Thank you.
No side effects, Joe, that you've noticed? Nothing going on that's insidious?
No, it's just a vitamin B compound.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you.
And in Anarchy, Cambria, good morning to you. Long time haven't heard from you. Good morning.
John, nice to talk to you. Professor, I wondered about heredity, because my father was a shocking sleeper. My brother and I are terrible, and two of my children are, and now some of my grandchildren are.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a hereditary component to sleep quality, or, you know, I guess what we might colloquially say, the ability to sleep. Absolutely. It does run in family. We know insomnia runs in families. Good sleep runs in families. And so there is a component to it. It doesn't mean that your entire family is destined to always be bad sleepers. And folks can do things to obviously sort of fight the biology and still get good sleep. But the short answer is yes, it definitely runs in families.
All right. There you are, Cambria. There's your answer. And Chris in Emerald, morning to you, Chris.
G'day, John and Doctor. I just wanted to share a bit of a story. I was diagnosed with sleep apnea probably 10 years ago and went onto the CPAP machine. I don't ever sleep without it. But I noticed people at work, particularly in the afternoon, in meetings, people dropping off to sleep. And so I'd question them about, does your wife complain about you snoring? Oh, yeah, terrible. I said, well, maybe you've got sleep apnea. You might need to do a test. So I reckon it was about four of my colleagues went off, had the sleep tests, and, yes, they had severe sleep apnea. And one came back and said, Chris, you have saved my life.
Wow.
Because his was so bad that it could have caused him to have a stroke or whatever. So I just thought I'd relay that. People need to, if they're using the technology, they need to share it with people, be open about it, well, be open with people like we need to be open about death and dying.
Yeah, and Chris, it's about that whole thing, particularly blokes who hate being honest about health with anyone, let alone a doctor.
Mm. Yeah, Chris, I actually want to thank you for what is actually a very good public service in trying to get folks to get tested. Sleep apnea is probably one of the most underdiagnosed sleep disorders and maybe medical disorders, generally speaking, out there. And it can have devastating effects, as you suggest. It can lead to long-term consequences for the heart, for the brain. It leads to heart attacks and strokes and high blood pressure and diabetes. And so
car crashes,
accidents at work, lots of bad stuff. And so encouraging folks who might have symptoms like being loud snorers, a bed partner telling them they stop breathing at night, being overweight, being very sleepy in the afternoon despite getting what they thought was good sleep at night. All of those things are potential symptoms, and getting screened is a really, really good idea. So thank you for encouraging your friends to do that.
Good on you, Chris. No more callers, but I do have one more text. And it's I don't know if it's tongue-in-cheek or real, but any comment, please, from the professor on the relationship between conscience and sleep? Remember the saying, I don't know how they sleep at night. Is there any science to back that up? Do people sleep better if they live a virtuous moral life?
That is a fascinating question. I'm not aware of any science that that has looked at that, but it's a really, really interesting idea.
How would you test it? That's the next thing.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to go to some folks in philosophy departments and try to figure out how you test moral consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, and come up with some standards and then apply them to the community. I love the question. I'm delighted that your answer was as frank as it is. Sean, it's been fascinating. The phone's been ringing off the hook and the text messages have been coming through at an alarming rate, which shows that really we have a great a hunger for sleep and people wanting to improve something that is so fundamental to our lives, but still such a problem for so many. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was an honor to be here. Thank you much.
Professor Sean Drummond, President of the Sleep Research Society, Professor of Clinical Neurosciences at the Monash Institute of Cognitive and Clinical Neurosciences, and is in the Sleep Program at Monash University.